the glass is half full, not half empty, and it's half full of whiskey.
Hello, and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and today we're talking about the cocktail culture in New Orleans.
Yes, because drinking is a major part of what New Orleans is, of that joie de vivre we heard about while we were in the city a couple of months back. And also, you, listener, might have heard in our first episode we did on New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people talked about it. And the culture around drinking is pretty unique to New Orleans, at least here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That quote you heard at the top is from Chef Isaac Toops of Toops Meadery, and it captures a lot of the attitude we encountered around alcohol in the city and, in general, having a good time. I mean, we're talking about a city that lays claim to, I don't know, 47 cocktails? I made up that number, but it's a lot.
It is so many.
Mm-hmm. And I got to say, as we record this, the Super Bowl just took place in our city of Atlanta.
Promise this is related.
It is. And one thing that we, Lauren, super producer Dylan, and I all commented on was how New Orleans was such a big football town, bigger than any of us thought it was.
Yeah.
And everyone was a Saints fan, everyone we talked to. And so right now there are all these signs in downtown Atlanta that say the Saints were robbed, because you probably know. But there's that whole thing, a bad call in a game, and a lot of Saints fans and other people said it cost the Saints the game and their chance at the Super Bowl. There's even legal action. On top of that, our mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, got into some hot water, not for her gumbo or for her mac and cheese, but for saying she hoped the Saints weren't one of the Super Bowl teams.
Ooh.
Because she was worried about their fan base, very passionate. And this was, she said this before the Saints lost, and she had to release an official apology. It's been interesting. And I heard an interview with a Saints fan a couple of weeks ago before the Super Bowl took place, and he said that it was all tied into this community aspect that we, Lauren, Dylan, and I all observed while we were there, too. And it does relate back to the cocktail scene.
Yeah, and not only because football fandom often involves drinking.
Yep.
Okay, to explain another anecdote. We were getting out of a cemetery tour, the St. Louis Cemetery No. 1, to be precise, as the Saints started playing a game. And the bar we dropped by after this tour had the game on. And the patrons were having a potluck in the bar.
Yeah.
And y'all tell me if I'm just hanging out at the wrong bars, but that is a sense of community that I found equally unfamiliar and delightful. Alongside that community and the pride in that community and its history, New Orleans has a cultural sense of drinking alcohol. One that is miles away from the tourist concept of the city as a place to, like, get drank.
Yeah.
Although the two are related, both come from the city's historically non-puritanical approach to alcohol and specifically its open container laws.
More than once, we had an easier time finding absinthe. Absinthe as opposed to coffee.
Side note, this is actually a weird reversal, or like maybe a continuation of a historical thing in New Orleans where bars were taxed heavily but coffee shops weren't. And loophole, you could serve booze out of a coffee shop. So at one point there were over 350 registered coffee houses in the city in like the early 1800s. It's more direct now. Yeah, just cut out that coffee middleman. Go straight to the absinthe.
Right, right. So we were like, I guess we can have absinthe at 10 in the morning. Which is as good a segue as any, I guess, to say drink responsibly.
Yes.
Yes. Liz Williams over at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans put it this way.
We are professional drinkers. Really. I mean that seriously. We learn how to drink from the time we're children. And you watch people drink and you learn what the rules are and all that sort of thing. And so the amateurs are the ones who drink until they throw up all the time and all that kind of thing. So.
While we were there, we caught up with a particularly expert drinker, Elizabeth Pierce, the founder of Drink and Learn, which is both a walking tour that looks into the history of beverages in general and cocktail culture specifically, and it's a podcast.
Visit drinkandlearn.com or find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah.
But no, really, it's great. Y'all should check it out. And all right, if you're going to be a drinks historian, New Orleans is a pretty okay place to do it. But as Elizabeth told us, she came to the profession in a roundabout way.
So I helped to create and open the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I was the founding curator there. despite having no academic background in museums or history. A strong liberal arts education prepares you to do anything, which I bet both of you, all of you, might agree with, right?
Absolutely.
So I worked with Liz Williams for 4 years, learning how to make something out of nothing, and that mattered because the museum opened in early 2008, and of course that year ended with the great financial apocalypse. Funding dried up, everybody got laid off. I went on unemployment, drank heavily, and dated a musician, which is the Holy Trinity if you just need to shift your professional path. So 2009 was the lost year. It was the year there were no jobs. It was the year that I learned that both unemployment and musicians run out after 6 months, my favorite joke, even though we're both still friends. And the museum stayed open through volunteers, but I needed a paying gig.
I love that, the Holy Trinity of shifting careers. We really could play the interview we did in its entirety, and there would still be more to talk about when it comes to New Orleans and cocktails. Elizabeth went on to talk about the lure of drinking in New Orleans to tourists and what outsiders get and don't get about it.
New Orleans and drinking is how many people understand my city. Some people come for the architecture, and they totally should. We have beautiful architecture. We have amazing food and music. But there are other cities that also have these elements. But somehow, additionally, people come here and they expect to drink a lot. Or they expect to see a lot of people drinking, even if they're not drinking. And they will either look upon in bemusement or judgment or horror. But the expectation is always there.
To be fair, this is a thing that the locals absolutely market to tourists.
Right. And she talked about that, too, when we were doing this interview with her. One of my favorite things that I looked on in bemusement while we were in New Orleans, there was this excellent people-watching spot that we did of an establishment called the Bourbon Cowboy. And one gray, drizzly day, we were drinking our morning absinthe and looking into the Bourbon Cowboy across the street. And a gentleman in a Marty McFly Jr. hat was shouting, "Beer," while holding a sign that said, "Three Buds," as in Budweiser's, "for the price of one, dilly dilly." And he was holding the sign horizontally when it was definitely supposed to be held vertically. And this is also where we saw a man with a goat.
Like walking a goat, or trying to. The goat stopped in front of this one bar and didn't seem to want to leave.
No.
He was like, "This is my bar. This is my stop. Do whatever you want." But no, the tourist drinking culture is different from the local concept. Here's Dickie Brennan, whose family collectively owns and operates 13 restaurants in the city.
It's so much a part of how we New Orleanians live life, you know, and so it's a daily part of our culture is connecting with people, and the majority of that is connecting on a table with food. And how can you not have a great meal without spirits, wine? And it's such a rich tradition in this city.
A tradition that goes back pretty much to the city's founding.
Keep in mind that Louisiana was founded a little differently than most places in what would become the United States. Here's Elizabeth again.
We were founded by France. We were left alone by France because they couldn't figure out a way to make money from New Orleans. A lot of people that were sent here were not people who could necessarily take care of themselves in a swampy environment, like thieves and prostitutes and criminals in general. The illustrative quote about that is there was a governor, our last French governor, Carolac. He was sent over to clean up the town, and he told Louis, whichever Louis it was, 14, 15, something, it's like, if I sent home all of the criminal elements of New Orleans or Louisiana, there would be no one left. So, but what that means is you had people who were already skewed to not entirely respect the law and then had nothing to support the thought that they should. And you can contrast that with another colony that is growing around the same time, and that would be in New England. But the people who settled in New England were not thieves, criminals. They were very earnest. They were hardworking. They believed in you know, that, that God had brought them to this new place. And the way that the pilgrims drank was they drank beer because that was safe, you know, safe drinking instead of water. And being a drunk was viewed as something that could be very detrimental to the colony. If you're drunk, then you can't plow, can't build a cabin or whatever. It wasn't only about the morality of intoxication. It was about the logistics of the colony. And that was not around here. Like, that was not an issue. It was a very independent streak. And also way more men than families. The women come later. And so you have a lot of single men in a pretty crappy situation with unreliable food, maybe, you know, hunting. Maybe the Native Americans are going to give you something. But, like, the one solid, the one through line is rum doesn't spoil. Or brandy, if you could get it.
Rum, of course, was in great supply due to New Orleans being a port of trade with the Caribbean and its sugar plantations. And by the first couple decades of the 1800s, sugarcane was the foremost plantation crop in southern Louisiana, too. Rum is an excellent way to profit on waste produced during sugar refinement, so it was in owners' interest to also run distilleries. And because of the slave labor used in sugar and rum, rum was cheap and plentiful in the area. Meanwhile, grape-based brandy was the French go-to liquor at the time, what with all their wine vineyards, although that would have been imported and more expensive. Also, it was considered medicinal.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Those two liquors would wind up being the bases of lots of New Orleans cocktails. The third also came to the party because the city was a port on the Mississippi River.
So the city flourishes in the 1830s. So now we got families and stuff. However, who is coming here to unload their raft from Kentucky? These, like, wild drinking, they were called cane tucks. Just still a word we toss around every now and then. And, you know, it's like a jug of whiskey chained to the rudder. You're pulling down the river. You arrive, you sell whatever it is you're selling, and now you're a single man in a port town with money in your pocket, and you multiply that by the thousands. So it is this, it isn't the only thing that's happening here, but it is happening for a considerable amount of time that New Orleans is a party town. But anyway, so all of these, like, facets contribute to an identity. And that one of the pillars of that identity is about cutting loose. And drinking is an integral part of that. Eventually, that is, like, woven into how people understand New Orleans. And so these elements, this, like, cocktail culture or drinking culture, actually let's call it drinking culture, was defined early on, like late 19th century. Like these the Sazerac, the old fashioned, a Manhattan, like these things have just been part of this through line, this thread. And so we just kept doing the same dance over and over. Plus we liked them. They're delicious.
Yes, they are. I think we had some of all of those cocktails while we were in New Orleans.
Yep.
And some of those cocktails we enjoyed in to-go cups, or also better known as go cups in the city. Why is this a thing in New Orleans, but not really in most of the United States? We'll get into that after a quick break for a word from our sponsor. Back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
In case any of you listeners don't know, in most of the United States, drinking in public, as in outside of a restaurant or a bar or something like that, is illegal. Not so in New Orleans. That's one of its big draws as a tourist town. There are drive-through daiquiri bars. I can't even fathom that. A lot of bars have to-go windows where you can pick up a cocktail and then go about your way. And it has to do with several things we've already touched on. The French influence, the disregard, shall we say, for the laws, the threat of Catholicism as opposed to Puritanism. However, legally, this divide is relatively new. Here's Elizabeth.
So drinking in America in public was legal until about the 1960s. What was illegal was public drunkenness. And that goes like the pilgrim thing that I told you about. So in the 1950s, there was an alderman in Chicago who had been hearing from the police that they were struggling with this thing that was called bottle gangs. So it was a group of single men, indigent or homeless or whatever, and they'd pool their money and they'd buy one bottle of liquor, stand on a corner, and pass it around. Eventually, there'd be a fight, there'd be some sort of trouble, and the cops said, "We want to stop this before it starts. How can we do this?" And so the city council said, "Okay, no more drinking in public. Now you don't have to wait for somebody to be drunk or to cause a fight or whatever. We're going to nip this problem in the bud." Over time, other cities began adopting this because vagrancy laws began to be tossed out as unconstitutional. You can't arrest somebody just because they're hanging around. And so this was a way for cities to get in front of a homeless problem, what I even call the hobo factor. And of course, there were some people who were targeted and some people who weren't. People of color, if you're poor. And these laws are enacted piecemeal, cities, counties, across the country. And then, of course, if one county does it, then the county next to it will do it, because then people are just moving, right? So eventually, it becomes pretty much illegal to drink anywhere in public in the United States by, like, the mid-1970s. In the meantime, New Orleans had a vice district prior to World War I. It closed, actually, because of World War I, because all of these soldiers were getting STDs, and the U.S. government was like, if you want to be a port of embarkation, you have to not have all the free love. So this vice district was also home of jazz, Storyville. And like Louis Armstrong played at Storyville, King Oliver, all these great musicians. So that gets shut down. And then it's Prohibition, which like everybody totally drank during Prohibition. But the clubs are, you know, less accessible, less reliable, because there were still raids and things. And it's not until World War II when we become a port of embarkation again, and you have tens of thousands of single young men with money in their pocket coming through here looking for a good time. And Bourbon Street was a commercial street. It was not an entertainment district. But a lot of these clubs that had closed before World War I kind of begin reopening. You create this new district.
We talked about how Prohibition was essentially ignored in New Orleans in our first episode that was an introduction to the city. So go check that out if you missed it. But in the meantime, I bet you can see where this is going. Elizabeth continued.
It's not until after World War II that you really begin to see Bourbon Street showing up in like travel magazines or tourism things. And again, it's clubs where people go inside to listen to music, to eat, and it's like going to Vegas and going to see a show, you know. And locals went there. It was classy. You wore your gloves, your hat, you know. So, unfortunately, many of these places were owned by the mob. And they were money laundering. There was prostitution and gambling happening in the back. And eventually we get an earnest DA who's like, I'm going to shut all this down, conducting lots of raids. And it becomes sort of seedier and seedier. Locals don't want to go. If you don't have vice money, then you can't really keep up the shine on the inside. And little by little, these clubs, they either close or they're barely staying open. Nobody wants to go in. And so one bright day, an unknown employee opened a window and sold a drink through that window. You don't even have to come in my club. I'll just sell you a drink right here. And soon, a lot of people started doing it, particularly on Bourbon Street. The city council tried to shut it down. The law was overturned as being like too vague, so I think they wrote it hastily. By then, everybody's making a lot of money, and people really like it because you can't do it anywhere else in the United States. Initially, the plan was to just keep it in the French Quarter, and they decided that would be too confusing for tourists, which is actually what Savannah did. Savannah kept it in a historic district, but not the rest of the city. But they've been pushing it. Everybody's pushing it because if you're like one block over, why can't I do that, you know? So here we are. So that is why it is legal to walk around with a drink here. But I always encourage visitors to try to drink in the open like we do, which is, it's not a desperate forced march where you have to arrive at a destination of profound intoxication in a very short time. But instead, it's just like we pour a go cup, as we call them, go cup. My husband and I pour a go cup and we walk our dog.
It's really lovely. Mm-hmm. You could get a go cup in the airport in New Orleans. It's one of the things I missed the most immediately when I got back. It's just nice to sort of Rihanna it, as they say, because, you know, she's always walking out of restaurants with those glasses of wine, to not feel rushed, to leave an establishment when you want and to enjoy a leisurely stroll. Mm-hmm. The attitude is just different there. My mom and I used to go to Savannah once a year, and we would get a cocktail and walk along the river in the Market District and just enjoy ourselves. I think that's a part of it, too, taking that time to relax. And if you overdo it, well, the attitude around that is different, too. Here's Elizabeth again.
We live in what was in a country that is governed by a very profound Protestant ethic. You know, how many listicles about productivity can there possibly be? You think you've seen them all. And that is not it's not high in the list of values of New Orleans. It doesn't mean that we don't accomplish anything, but we value, you know, interaction and family and friends, you know, all that. And so because of that, if you have too much to drink and you wake up hungover, as long as you have not bothered anybody, then no one is shaking their finger at you and saying, oh, you wasted, you know, the time. It's like, this happens. Try not to make it happen too regularly, but, like, this is what it is to be human.
This mindset around drinking, along with the creativity and rebellion inherent to the city that gave us jazz, and all this combining of cultures, made New Orleans fertile ground for inventing, or at least popularizing, cocktails.
Yes. Even before we went to New Orleans, I feel like it comes up all the time, somewhere or another, in our cocktail and alcohol episodes that city does. And like we were talking about in our gumbo episode, a lot of them tell the story of the city in a glass.
Yeah, okay, so you had that rum and brandy and whiskey all coming in. You had champagne from France, and when absinthe hit big over there, New Orleans picked that up, too. Around the same time, in the early to mid-1800s, pharmacists like one Antoine Pichot were concocting the herbal tinctures sold at the time as medicine that we know today as bitters. Pichot's bitters. A trade coming up through the Caribbean and South America brought citrus and other tropical fruit.
And all of that is how we get these classic New Orleans cocktails. The Sazerac, the Vieux Carré, the Grasshopper, the Hurricane, the Ramos Gin Fizz, the French 75, the Pimm's Cup. I hear people shouting angrily now.
I am one of them. Yes, those last two are from Paris and London.
Yeah.
But New Orleans does lay a certain amount of claim to them, and in cases like those, I'd say that the confusion or argument over which place or which bartender made a drink first is indicative of the economic and cultural trade happening at various points in time. And that trade is the story of New Orleans.
Elizabeth spoke to this on her podcast with an episode about the Sazerac from July of 2018, which y'all should check out. And the episode is called The Sazerac.
Makes sense.
Hey. But here's a taste.
Abigail and I tell the entire history of New Orleans using only the ingredients in a Sazerac cocktail. So the Sazerac is the official cocktail of New Orleans. In 2008, the Louisiana legislature passed a resolution making the Sazerac the city's official drink. And that sounds like a joke, but in fact, it is just grounded in the story of the city. And every component of it was either invented here, found a home here, is illustrative of people who came here, whether it's French, Caribbean, American, all of these forces that kind of combined to inform the evolution of the city. It's a story I tell a lot because I get hired to do it. I think really more than any cocktail I can think of, there's so much just literally in the glass.
What's in the glass, by the way?
Oh, Sazerac. What is it?
Well, what's in the glass is a rye whiskey, absinthe or another anise-flavored liqueur, a cube of sugar, crushed, bitters, and lemon peel, chilled and served straight up. It's complex. It's bitter and strong and sweet and refreshing. Definitely a Sazerac episode in our future, with all due respect to Drink and Learn.
Yep. And we made sure to drink some of those while we were in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Of those others that we mentioned above, though, perhaps one of my favorites is the Ramos Gin Fizz. Ready for it?
Always.
What is it?
Well, this is a perhaps obviously gin-based drink with lemon and lime juice, orange flower water, bit of sugar, and then dairy and egg white whipped into a lovely, bright floral foam with a layer of silky punch beneath it. It's often thought of as a breakfast or brunch drink, an eye-opener, as folks like to call them. One of the most famous places to order it in New Orleans is Broussard's, a French Quarter restaurant that will be celebrating its 100th anniversary next year. Been around for just a second.
Yeah.
And its connection with the Ramos Gin Fizz is due in no small part to the drink program at its Empire Bar, which was pioneered in 2013 by one Paul Gustings, who, if you haven't heard of, he was called by the online publication Neat Pour a legendary curmudgeon and bartender. And I think that just about sums it up.
Yeah, I think so. We spoke to Rebecca Chapman, the general manager at Broussard's, about this cocktail.
It really is. So the Ramos Gin Fizz is this incredible concoction. The way that it's we describe it to guests when they taste it, it's like a key lime pie, right? So it's a key lime pie in a glass. And essentially what happens is when you have heavy cream, gin, orange flower water, but you have to be really, really light-handed with the orange flower water. You only want to do maximum of 3 drops, but 3 very small drops because it's an incredibly powerful ingredient. The heavy cream and then egg whites. So what you do is you build all of that into your shaker and then your ice. And essentially you're almost making, when you start to do your shake, which should be, so it's rumored that you're supposed to do an 8-minute shake. Dang. To get the perfect Ramos Gin Fizz. I don't have those kind of guns. And you'll start to feel and hear the meringue building in the tent. So the ice is acting as the blender technique. And as you start to get that figure eight motion when you're building, you will feel the air building and the meringue starting to build. So then when you go to pour, you still have liquid. And so then it's adding even more air, making that meringue grow. And then the final step to get that nice, beautiful frothiness is to add seltzer or club soda, whichever your preference may be. So then that continues to grow and you get that beautiful marshmallowy meringue, gorgeous topping. But it's tasty and it's refreshing. So I've gotten myself in trouble a couple times.
8 minutes. 8 minutes.
You know, you either, the bartender that you go and ask for a Rainbow Shin Fizz for is either going to love you or hate you. Like, there's no if, and, or other. It's either going to be a delighted bartender ready to shake the hell out of something, or it's going to be that aggravated grunt of, okay, all right, this is what we're doing. But for the most, I'll be honest, it is fun. It's fun to see everyone's face when you make it. It is incredible. It is a little labor intensive. So like all good things, you know, they come to those who wait.
Legend has it that it was invented in 1888 by one Henry C. Ramos at the Imperial Cabinet Saloon, where he retained rights to the drink until his son sold it, after Prohibition, to the Sazerac Bar at the Roosevelt Hotel, which was frequented at the time by posh people like Louisiana Governor and Senator Huey Long.
You know, it was rumored that Huey P. Long stole a bartender from the Roosevelt Hotel. Mm-hmm. So there was Sazerac Bar located inside. So in that bar, basically Huey P. Long insisted that he hired that bartender and they follow them around the country making the Ramos Gin Fizz for him because he made the best one.
Oh, wow. He must have had awesome arms,
right?
We also visited our nose, which celebrated its 100th anniversary last year. Over that century that it has existed, our nose basically took over a whole city block with this like amalgam of dining rooms and bars and kitchens and event spaces and a Mardi Gras costume museum. One part of the complex is a bar called French 75, after the cocktail. Hey, don't get cheeky. What the French 75 is a matter of some debate. It's definitely lemon juice, a bit of sugar, and a sparkling wine to top it off. But the base liquor, that can be a couple of things. We spoke in the French 75 bar with Katie Kasparian, who is Arnaud's co-owner and operator.
You know, there's some speculation on whether the French 75 cocktail was originally created with gin or with cognac. We think it was with cognac. We think it tastes better with cognac. Ours is made with cognac. And so I think that we probably serve more French 75s than any other place in the world. And it's just become our sort of signature cocktail, not just in here, but throughout the restaurant. And it's delicious. It's refreshing. And we think that there was a resurgence in the country because of it.
I do love a French 75.
Yeah, they're
exactly, just refreshing is a lovely way to put it. They will knock you on your butt.
They will. they're suspicious in the way that they do it because you don't know what's happening until all of a sudden you're down. But it's good. It's a good fall. Yeah.
Another future cocktail hour for sure.
Oh yeah.
One cocktail we won't be doing a future episode on, but can't help mentioning, is one that Elizabeth told us about a friend of hers accidentally concocting.
My friend Steve Yamada, who works at Latitude 29, fantastic tiki bar, super talented bartender, kind of made his way, worked his way up, did a lot of catering gigs, whiskey soda, rum and coke kind of thing, didn't know anything about cocktails. And so he parlayed like this past catering experience and eventually gets a job at Bubba Gump's. So somebody orders an old fashioned and he doesn't know what that is. And so we asked the bartender, it was like an old guy. It's like, how do I make that? What do I do? Because there was no internet then. So he says, grab the bottle with the paper on it, meaning the bitters. Just make, to put some whiskey and sugar, mush up a cherry, and then the bottle with the paper.
Oh no.
Steve made an old fashioned with Worcestershire sauce. And it was not sent back. He made four of them that night, presumably for the same person, who thought, what an interesting, and I mean, like, at its essence, it is a bitter product, you know, umami.
I'd try it. Speaking of umami and different takes on cocktails, let's take a look at the modern cocktail scene in New Orleans. But first, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, the United States, as you may have noticed, is in the midst of a vast craft cocktail renaissance after the dark ages of the 80s and its prepackaged, sweetened-to-heck drink mixes. Look, science. Just because you can approximate sour mix with corn syrup and citric acid doesn't mean you should. Anyway.
This is Jurassic Park of cocktail arguments. It's interesting because New Orleans has the intergenerational community aspect, so they never really rejected the old stodgy cocktails of their parents like most Americans did. Those never went out of fashion, but the 80s still had an impact. Think of those slushy machines.
And if that's what you're looking for, you will find it.
Yes.
But the larger craft movement has opened up a lot of opportunities. Take the aforementioned French 75 bar. It was only rebranded with that name in 2001, which was during the early surge of that craft renaissance. And even those slushes have gotten some fancy treatments. Dickie Brennan talked about his take on the old school milk punch, which is one of those eye openers we talked about, made with sweetened milk and your liquor of choice.
I grew up where we made a basic milk punch, and for years it was brandy milk punch. Then our family started doing bourbon milk punch. So I grew up with a very simple bourbon milk punch recipe. And when we opened up here on Bourbon Street, Bourbon House, this proliferation of daiquiri shops up and down the street, you know, and they're real sweet. I mean, not knocking them. And the fun thing about New Orleans, you could walk up and down the street with a cocktail. So we knew we wanted to do something to add to enhance, to be a little different. And so we created a frozen bourbon milk punch. It's, I call it an adult milkshake. It's basically, you know, it's not what you would find in the daiquiris, you know, sweet. Not, it, I mean, this is, it's a custard that we freeze with bourbon and, you know, and it's really become one of our signature items. So it was a good evolution.
We got to try some. They were delicious.
Oh, yeah. It's got nutmeg on top.
It was wonderful. We also got a chance to talk about the current state of the cocktail scene with Bryson Downham, beverage director for Toops South and Toops Meadery. Interestingly, like Elizabeth, he took a bit of an indirect route to the industry.
Yeah, I got really, really fascinated by making drinks because at the time I wasn't really like the taste of alcohol. But I would have a dry cocktail and be impressed and think it was good. So I wanted to do this thing where I would take something that is literally poison and almost repulsive to the palate and craft it with my own hands into something that is beautiful and tasty. And also, so my degrees are in neuroscience. So the social aspect was also important because I didn't want to be locked away in a lab with a bunch of very quiet people all day, and being at the bar, being in the restaurant.
You kind of do the opposite.
People. Yeah, total.
A bunch
opposite.
Of loudmouths.
but now I get to manipulate people's brain chemistry in a much more hands-on fashion. So I still think that I am working within my field.
No argument here. Mm. We asked Bryson about some of the new drinks he's working on and what he is excited about.
Yeah, and also the incorporation of different ingredients that haven't traditionally been thought of as drink ingredients, like more like savory things, and like thinking about it more as a dish, like a composed dish, than just a one note or even a nuanced cocktail that you only utilize as traditional things. Like we use a lot of salt and black pepper and other seasonings, cumin and whatnot, in cocktails here, and it's a lot of fun. It makes for a more unique experience with your drink. And that's definitely going on throughout the country. You see more and more like vegetable bases and things like that in your drinks. And I'm interested to see how far it goes and what people come up with as they begin to incorporate more and more non-traditional ingredients in drinks.
Dickie Brennan summed up the recent past and future of cocktails in New Orleans this way.
You know, going way back in time with the creation of a cocktail, I think it was just a part of the daily routine. You know, they were called coffee houses, and that's where you would take the break to go in and have a drink, you know, in the middle of the day or in the morning. You know, when I lived in France, if you'd go to the market early in the morning and you go into the coffee shops, someone might be having an espresso, but someone else is having a cocktail, you know, and then, you know, an absinthe or whatever. So I think a lot of that culture was here in the city, drinking. But what I love about today is it's like when in the 80s we started educating with culinary institutes. We now have a generation and they've gotten educated in the spirits world. Whether we call them mixologists, you know, not quite sure yet where we're going with the name, but they're professionals and they really can give a customer an experience that you didn't experience when you walked in and said, give me an old fashioned. You know, now it's, what bourbon would you like with your old fashioned? You know, and then the young mixologist saying, well, tell me kind of what do you like? You know, what do you like, sweet? Do you like bitter? You know, and picks the right rum or picks the right bourbon for you to have that great experience. So, I mean, it's, I don't know what it's going to look like in 10 years, but what's happened the last 10 years has been crazy, certainly in the spirits world.
Let's end with some advice from Amy Sins, founder of Langlois, for those visiting New Orleans.
As a resident of the French Quarter, I will say when it comes to drinking in New Orleans, if it is red, green, or purple and served in a cup on Bourbon Street, do not drink more than one. If I am off on a Friday night, there is nothing more exciting than watching the security cameras outside my house and watching what happens to people who drink more than one. But also, it is a marathon, not a sprint. Pace yourself and eat every 3 hours. If you're not eating every 3 hours, you cannot fit it in. And remember that 3 days is not enough. You really need to be here for a week. And before you come, my suggestion is that you eat as much as you can for 2 weeks before you get here. Then you can stretch your stomach and then you can eat more when you get here. There are people who have this idea that they're gonna eat less and diet so they can enjoy more of the calories here. Don't worry, we keep the calories at the airport when you leave, so it's okay. But definitely be prepared to eat and experience as much as you can. And even if it's something you think you don't like, try it. Always give something 3 attempts. So if you say, I don't like okra, eat 3 different kinds of okra dishes. And whatever it is, if you really hate it, eat it fried and you'll probably love it. So,
very sound advice. This brings us to the end of our third episode in our New Orleans series of episodes. If you would like to write to us, we would love to hear from you. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
You can also find us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @SaverPod. We do hope to hear from you. Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard, and our executive producer, Christopher Hatsiotis, and all of our interviewees, and the good folks who put us in touch with them. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.
We have to talk about what happened at this bar, because they, for one thing, it's like 9:30. The tour starts at 10. They have a 2-for-1 hurricane special.
Yeah, if you have a ticket for the tour, yes, then it's 2-for-1 hurricanes for like $8 or $12 or something like that.
Yes. And the bartender at this particular bar was one of my favorites that we encountered because, okay, I didn't realize that New Orleans was a big football town, one. And it was the day of a Saints game.
Yeah.
And he was just like already pre-angry at everyone.
Ruining his Saints time.
Yes. Yeah. And there was a guy in a kilt.
Right.
Who was playing the ukulele.
Oh, yeah. He was playing ukulele. He had a monster dog.
Yes.
Yeah.
Monster in size. Yeah. He was very sweet.
A very sweet dog. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some kind of,
I
don't know.
Pyrenees?
Yeah. I think it was a Great Pyrenees. Yeah.
Bear Pyrenees.
Half bear.
Half bear. Half Pyrenees.
Who knew science was capable of such a thing? But there he was.
It was the sweetest dog, and I could have ridden him into battle.
Yes.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And that man would have come along with you into battle.
He would have.
Yeah.
He would have. Oh, he was very nice.
Yeah, he was. Like he was like a D&D character personified. Yes. of the Bard.
Of the Bard.
Yes.
He was playing Holy Diver by Dio on a ukulele. Yeah.
I mean, it was spectacular.
It was.
It was spectacular.
And the bartender was like, I think you hit a sour note there, buddy. Why don't you try again? Like, he was just critiquing him in real time.
Yeah. The guy was like, oh, I guess I did. And went and played it back.
Yeah. It was great. They have a very funny, that's a comedic duo if I've ever, that movie needs to be made.
Absolutely.